Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the lightning speed with which major Iraqi cities are falling to fighters with ISIS, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, and assess the military situation on the ground in Iraq with a former intelligence officer in the U.S. Army in Iraq, Jessica Lewis, the research director at the Institute for the Study of War, who is the Institute's lead analyst with their Al-Qaeda portfolio and the author of Al-Qaeda in Iraq Resurgent, Parts 1 and 2. We'll discuss the likelihood of the Sunni jihadists blowing up Shiite shrines to inflame the conflict further and the amount of military equipment falling into the hands of ISIS, as well as the US evacuates its personnel from the Balad air base just north of Baghdad. Then James Galvin, a professor of history at UCLA, who is a specialist on the Middle East, particularly Greater Syria and the area of present-day Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, and the Palestinian territories, joins us. We will discuss the Syria as well as the Iraq dimension to the explosion of ISIS onto the world stage and how much the ambitious maps that ISIS displays will come to fruition as they try to impose their Islamic caliphate on the region. Then finally, Sebastian Younger joins us in the studio to discuss his latest feature documentary, Korangal, the sequel to the Academy Award-nominated Restrepo. He is the best-selling author of The Perfect Storm, A Death in Belmont, and War, and we will discuss his and the late Tim Hetherington's 10 months spent with a group of American soldiers in a remote mountain outpost under constant Taliban attacks and how the war in Afghanistan affects the soldiers on the front line. And joining us now is Jessica Lewis, the research director at the Institute for the Study of War, where she's also the lead architect for technology and data strategy, as well as the lead analyst for the Institute's Al-Qaeda in Iraq portfolio. Her military career included 34 months deployed in Iraq and Afghanistan, serving on active duty as an intelligence officer in the U.S. Army in Iraq, and she is the author of Al-Qaeda in Iraq Resurgent and Al-Qaeda in Iraq Resurgent Part 2. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jessica Lewis.
Thank you so much for having me.
And when you say Al-Qaeda in Iraq Resurgent, I guess even this might have caught you by surprise. What's happening now?
Well, in one sense, yes. I am very surprised at how fast ISIS has been able to move from Mosul onto more cities in central Iraq. And I'm very surprised at how quickly the Iraqi army folded in these northern cities. I did expect that Nineveh province and the capital of Mosul, which is Iraq's second largest city, would be a prized objective for the Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant, the group that had once been known as Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Because this was, among other things, the place where their senior leadership fled to when they were fighting coalition forces in 2008. So this has always been very significant terrain to them, so I'm not surprised to see them push to control Mosul, but I am very surprised to see how quickly they succeeded.
And how much military equipment do we know they have? Because if they have a number of tanks, that could prove pretty decisive, couldn't it?
Well, it is a good question about what equipment they have been able to achieve since taking over military bases that had once belonged to the Iraqi army, particularly in Mosul. We should expect that the equipment and the munitions in the Mosul International Airport compound, for example, now belong to ISIS, and vehicles and armored vehicles and even tanks may be among them. One of the things that we saw in the context of the Syrian war is that sometimes the tanks are not the most useful. So it becomes the burden of the receiving element to figure out how to fight with them. But as of this morning, the spokesperson for the Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant has claimed to have Humvees and armored vehicles and even planes in their inventory. I do not know if they know how to drive them.
Well, the Balad Air Force Base just north of Baghdad, the Americans who are presumably they're training the Iraqis on the F-16s that the U.S. is supplying, they're pulling out. I imagine they'll pull the planes out too, won't they?
Well, I think the closer that ISIS moves to bases that could possibly be overrun, the more that the Iraqi government will seek to remove the equipment and pull the line ahead of the ISIS advance. The struggle with this is that the Iraqi government has already moved those retreating forces very near to Baghdad, and there's not much farther that the government can contract to Baghdad. Balad is not very far from Baghdad. So if they were to pull out of Balad, I don't know where they would go that they would think would be more safe at this point. At some point, the Iraqi army is going to have to hold.
But at this point, just in terms of political leadership, they couldn't even get a quorum. Maliki couldn't even get a quorum in the parliament. Perhaps some of the members have already fled. I don't know what the situation is, but he has not ever been particularly deft at including the Sunnis. In fact, he's been responsible, I think, for a lot of the polarization. And Ayad Alawi, the leading Sunni politician, has said that he doesn't want the U.S. intervention, particularly air power, because he doesn't want to escalate the war. So how do you navigate between those two positions?
Well, I think you're absolutely right that there are no political solutions that Maliki can invoke at this point that is going to make the security situation better. I think instead that we all need to ask the question whether Maliki needs to go in order for Iraq to be able to come up with alternate solutions.
Well, of course, that we could go back to the first election, which I think Alawi won, but he wasn't able to put a government together. And clearly the marginalization of the Sunnis has been ongoing. How much do you think it's played into al-Baghdadi's hands and ISIS's hands, given that he spent quite a bit of time in a prison in Camp Buka from 2005, where he apparently made contacts with both al-Qaeda and with some of the Ba'athists? And my understanding is that fighting alongside ISIS in Iraq is a group called Jaish Rijal al-Tariq al... Let me just give you the acronym there, the JRTN.
So, yes, indeed.
So tell me about some... Clearly, there's some tacticians, if not strategists, involved in ISIS's lightning moves here. Could they be former Ba'athists?
I think that the strategists who have been designing, preparing, and executing this ISIS campaign are absolutely veterans of a professional military. And as I take inventory for which militaries that could possibly have been, I am looking at senior Ba'athist influence, which is a very scary prospect and a confusing one, because the Ba'athist endgame would likely be to control an intact Iraq, whereas the ISIS endgame is to make Iraq no more and set up a transnational Islamic emirate. So their ideals are not aligned, but strategists may look at defeating the Iraqi security forces and making the current government of Iraq paralyzed and not able to defend itself as a goal that both of them can leverage, such that the present imagery for the conflict appears to be ISIS on the offensive and JRTN and other Sunni insurgent groups who particularly dislike Maliki seizing opportunities to achieve their own objectives in the wake of the ISIS advance.
Again, I'm speaking with Jessica Lewis, who's the research director at the Institute for the Study of War, where she's also the lead architect for technology and data strategy, as well as the lead analyst for the Institute's Al-Qaeda in Iraq portfolio. Her military career included 34 months deployed in Iraq and Afghanistan, serving on active duty as an intelligence officer in the U.S. Army in Iraq. And she is the author of Al-Qaeda in Iraq Resurgent and Al-Qaeda in Iraq Resurgent Part 2. But what concerns me, and I spoke yesterday with former CIA officer Robert Baer, who was in charge of the CIA operations between the two wars against Iraq, and he was particularly concerned about the idea that given ISIS's move on Kabbala and Samarra, that those holy shrines, particularly the Golden Mosque, if they blow them up, which they want to do, given their religious fervor that tells them that the Shia are heretics. If that happens, wasn't the threats to those mosques, didn't that trigger the original sectarian violence going back to the early in the Second Gulf War?
Well, yes, the Samarra Mosque, the Al-Askari Mosque that is actually north of Baghdad, with the Golden Dome, was the attack by Al-Qaeda in Iraq that launched the sectarian civil war at that point. Since that time, the government of Iraq and the security forces, and very likely also Iranian forces, have been very concerned about protecting that shrine in particular, and by every means necessary, also the shrines in Karbala and Najaf. So I actually wonder, as ISIS declares the intent to attack the shrines that are south of Baghdad, whether they are actually trying to draw either Iraqi government forces or their supplements from the Iranian contingent down to those locations in order to take them off of other security objectives that are closer to where ISIS currently is.
But that's not to say that their intent would be to blow them up. Is there, although there are indications from what we're hearing from Mosul that the ISIS people are trying to tell the population that they're okay, they're not going to hurt them. In other words, they're not going to do what they did in what they do in Syria, which is impose Sharia law and alienate the population.
Well, to 2 points. Number one, I am not ruling out the possibility that ISIS is going to seek a spectacular attack upon one or more Shia shrines. What I do think they are ultimately going to do with the terrain that they control in northern Iraq even is exactly what they have done in al-Raqqa and Syria, and that what they're trying to do right now with the population is keep them in place so that ISIS is able to consolidate some of the control that it has just gained. So I think that their intent for how they control their state is actually best demonstrated by how they have acted at al-Raqqa.
But already the Kurdish Peshmerga are moving in, aren't they, to secure the oil refineries in that area. And of course, to them, Mosul is their city, and it was Saddam who Arabized it. So when are the Peshmerga going to be clashing with ISIS, do you think, if not already?
Well, the Peshmerga has begun to clash with ISIS, according to some Iraqi news reporting in the province of Kirkuk, such that I do think that this is a very relevant question. Will the government of Iraq actually ask the Peshmerga to support the overthrow of ISIS in major cities in Nineveh province, including Mosul? I'm not tracking that has happened yet, but I think that could be a game changer for Iraq's security vis-a-vis ISIS, and I think that it could be a very interesting political calculation by the Kurds.
But if ISIS does anything to these Turkish diplomats and their families that they're holding hostage, isn't there an alliance between the Sunni and the Turkmen, in effect, against the Kurds? I mean, my sense is that Turkey will be outraged if anything happens to those diplomats.
I am sure that they will be. I think that their calculus is also directly affected by the activities of the Peshmerga. Because if the Peshmerga does become a very active force in this equation, it likely increases the chance of Kurdish autonomy, which does directly affect Turkish interests also.
So this gives us an indication of how this is a powder keg that could ripple out. And, I mean, already there are lots of alarmists, perhaps accurate, I can't tell, but certainly maybe there's some hyperbole, the idea of this new state of ISIS is in Syria and Iraq. I suppose you can basically say they certainly have something already, but their ambitions are clearly greater, given that the ISIS, the last S, is, means essentially the Levant, not just Syria, right?
Well, yes, exactly. In fact, their maps have a tendency to fluctuate and expand when their campaigns are doing well. We should look at this organization as an expansionist military force that is going to press to expand its boundaries as far as it can. And while it expands, as demonstrated by Mosul, it is able to achieve new means to sustain and grow itself, not only by overwhelming bases and taking banks, but also by releasing prisoners.
Didn't they take, the estimates are 400 million they've taken from banks so far?
I have not heard that figure, but shortly I would imagine, and I have ultimately observed before that their campaigns have not been limited by financial thresholds before. So I think the primary point for me is that they have financial means.
But the prisoners that they've released, I mean, given the history of al-Baghdadi, their leader, in Camp Buka, the idea that they're taking territory at a lightning speed at the moment. But my understanding is, at least from the experience in Syria, is they may be good at taking territory, but they're not good at governance. The idea of governing through the Sharia law and that the Quran, you know, is the answer to everything, simply just doesn't work. So what's your sense of where the tribal leaders stand in Anbar, the people that Petraeus and company were able to engage in the surge that managed to extract, well, I guess it got President Bush and Dick Cheney's irons out of the fire. It, clearly, in retrospect, none of it's really worked. But in terms of that block, the traditional tribal leaders in Anbar, do we know where they are at now?
Well, they are not all on the same page. Mm-hmm. I think this is going to be a tribe-by-tribe decision. Some of them are going to decide to fight ISIS, and some of them are going to decide to fight the government. And I think that that's true for not just the tribes in Anbar, but also for the tribes in Salah ad-Din, in Kirkuk, and in Nineveh. So I think right now we really do see a mobilization of an anti-government force that is accumulating along with the ISIS advance, such that I think every tribe is trying to calculate its own future. I think the goal of any anti-ISIS force, any government or international community policy, should be very much to help the tribes decide, as they had before, that they can and should fight with the government to defeat ISIS and weigh in on the part of a pluralist government in Iraq.
So earlier, Jessica Lewis, when you mentioned that there may be an opportunity in this disaster, in the sense that Maliki, there could be a way to get rid of him and to start to build the kind of government that he should have built, instead of polarizing the country to the point where we have this disastrous situation. Would that involve wooing the tribes back and trying to, I mean, it seems pretty difficult to create a new government in the face of this unfolding military catastrophe, but nevertheless, it's better late than never, I guess.
Well, yes. I mean, the government of Iraq has many functions of state that are still going well for it, such that we are not talking about a government that would need to be rebuilt from scratch. Only the question is whether or not the tribes that no longer have state security to protect them are going to trust the state again. And if their discontent and if their lack of trust is personified in Maliki, then it really is a question as to whether or not they will reconsider abandoning their hope in the state if Maliki goes.
Well, certainly the one thing that comes to mind is the disastrous nature of what Brenda Wolfowitz and Feith did in disbanding the Iraqi army. Boy, you really need that army now, right? I mean, the idea that you had 400,000 people that could have maintained the peace and, you know, protected the borders, instead of using that army as a source of stability, they fired the whole bunch of them, and instead we ended up with angry, unemployed guys with guns. And look what it's led to. I mean, I know that there's a political recriminations going on now between the Republicans and Democrats, and a lot of blame is being laid on Obama's table. I guess it, you know, the buck stops there, right? But I find it a little bit disingenuous, some of these attacks on Obama.
Well, I do think that there's an interim step in terms of evaluating the status of the rebuilt Iraqi army. The status of the Iraqi army now is far worse than it was a few years ago. And the responsibility for that since December 2011 really rests solely with Maliki. Mm-hmm. So I think we should look not only at how it is that former strength of the state was vacated and new strength was to be built, but also to reflect on the fact that it had been.
Well, but the fact that we spent all that money, it clearly is not about money and equipment, is it? It's about leadership, or it seems to be.
Well, I think it is about leadership at every level, to include very much at this time the strategic and operational levels inside of the Iraqi army. There have to be military campaigns that can counter ISIS effectively for a government of Iraq to have a chance to regather around new leadership.
So just in closing then, Jessica Lewis, what's your sense of the next step? The president has said that nothing's off the table, but I mentioned what Ayad Alawi had said, you know, discouraging the idea of airstrikes from the U.S. So what do you think is likely to be the next stage in this, given the uncertainty of what's happening with this sort of lightning blitzkrieg that's going on?
Well, I think the conversation is going to start with this question of airstrikes and air support, because that has really been the aperture of maximum discussion in neighboring Syria, and it has been the context of increased levels of counterterrorism discussions and support before. My main concern with that framing is that this is actually not a counterterrorism problem anymore. The ISIS force is moving forth like a ground army, and I think we need to be speaking more in terms of a conventional counteroffensive to wrest control of this terrain from their hands. And airstrikes on urban capitals that ISIS has just begun to control really has the opportunity to be quite ineffective, and not just that, but extremely destructive upon Iraq's major cities. It may be ineffective because ISIS can, under duress in an urban environment, revert back to guerrilla warfare, and airstrikes will not actually defeat them. I think instead we need to be thinking about how to use air power in support of Iraqi army ground offensives. But sadly, that still boils down to the question of how a predominantly Shia Iraqi army, even if it is able to mount an effective counteroffensive, is going to match with Sunni insurgents who think that the government of Iraq will not be defending them. That is a bad dynamic. That is a dynamic that will lead to a civil war as well. So it really does boil down again to how the Sunni tribes who could take up arms with the government or against them received such a counteroffensive.
Well, Jessica Lewis, I thank you very much for your analysis. It's quite welcome in this very uncertain and rather explosive situation.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Jessica Lewis, who's the Research Director at the Institute for the Study of War, where she's also the lead architect for technology and data strategy, as well as the lead analyst for the Institute's Al-Qaeda in Iraq portfolio. Her military career includes 34 months deployed in Iraq and Afghanistan, serving on active duty as an intelligence officer in the U.S. Army in Iraq. And she is the author of Al-Qaeda in Iraq Resurgent and Al-Qaeda in Iraq Resurgent Part 2. And we're going to take a brief station break and be back looking into ISIS's transnational Islamic Emirate in Iraq and the Levant. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is James Galvin, a professor of history at UCLA. His research focuses on the Middle East, particularly Greater Syria, the area of present-day Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, and the Palestinian territories. And he's the author of Divided Loyalties, Nationalism, and Mass Politics in Syria at the Close of Empire, The Modern Middle East, a History. And his latest book is The Arab Uprisings, What Everyone Needs to Know. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Galvin.
Thank you for having me.
And James, the idea that ISIS, the last S is al-Shem, meaning it's not Syria, as it's often said, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. It's the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. So there's no shortage of ambition there. And our previous guest was talking about their maps that they put up periodically. What is their ultimate territorial ambition, do you know?
Well, they really haven't defined a territorial ambition. If you notice, most of the al-Qaeda-type groups do not use state names. For example, there's al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, al-Qaeda in the Islamic North Africa, for example. And that's because al-Qaeda itself rejects the boundaries that have been set up after World War I. They reject the state system itself. So when we talk about, you know, whether they're going to take over this state or this state, they don't look at it in that way. They look at it in terms of territory that they might be able to take. As far as ultimate goals are concerned, they have not, al-Qaeda has not defined its ultimate goal anything more than just a very, very vague idea of a united Islamic Ummah, as they call it, the community of believers. That would be ruled under Islamic law. They're very, very vague on this, which is why I compare them to an anarchist movement, which is stronger on being able to say what it's against than being able to say what it's for.
But these guys were, in effect, rejected by al-Qaeda, aren't they?
These guys are actually more al-Qaeda than the al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria. Let me explain. You're absolutely right. They were rejected, and they were told to go back to Iraq by Ayman al-Zawahiri, who is the head of al-Qaeda Central, and then they were pretty much booted out of the organization. The people that are recognized as the al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria is a group called Jabhat al-Nusra. Now, when I say that these guys are closer to al-Qaeda, it's because that Jabhat al-Nusra has junked almost every aspect of the al-Qaeda ideology. They are fighting in Syria, and Syria alone. Al-Qaeda doesn't believe in Syria or Lebanon or any other state. They have reduced the imposition of Sharia law that you had mentioned before in various places that they have taken back from ISIS. They have made no mention of any caliphate or emirate or anything along those lines. They're very, very different in that sense than ISIS is. ISIS carries with it, in its heart, the pure ideology of the al-Qaeda at its founding, whereas Jabhat al-Nusra, the official affiliate, doesn't. And it's very, very strange the way this whole thing worked out.
Well, but you, in effect, you can't blame them for wanting to not have borders and traditional states that were drawn up by the colonial powers, the British and the French, at the end of World War I. After all, Lloyd George and Clemenceau were playing games with each other, and they eventually made a deal where, Lloyd George insisted on keeping Mosul because of the oil. And in exchange for that, he gave Clemenceau, the French, Damascus. The arrogance and mendacity of the colonial powers was pretty extraordinary.
Yes, but there has been a lot of water under the bridge since that time. I agree with you 100%. And they did it a lot on racist concerns, a lot on classical education. Where did they pick these names from? Biblical education. Where did they pick these names from for these various states that they created? But the thing is that these states have not only held together, but in the Arab uprisings that took place in 2010, 2011, there was not a single uprising that said, hey, you know, Tunisia, Libya, Egypt, let's get rid of our boundaries, let's unite, etc. Libyans were fighting for the liberation of Libya, Tunisia for the liberation of Tunisia from an autocrat. Same thing in every other one of these things. The sense of Syrianness among Syrians is very, very strong. This is probably the reason why Jabhat al-Nusra and ISIS take two very, very different stances on the question of national borders. Jabhat al-Nusra, you can tell by the names of the leaders. Jabhat al-Nusra is led by a guy by the name of Jolani, which means that he comes from the Golan, which was part of Syria until 1967. Baghdadi takes his name from Baghdad. He's actually from Samarra, but, you know, maybe it's like guys from New Jersey claiming to be from New York. Who knows? The thing is, though, that These are foreign fighters, as far as Syrians are concerned, on their soil. ISIS are foreign fighters on their soil. They are interlopers into a Syrian revolution. This is one among many reasons why they're very unpopular.
Well, James Gelvin, at this point, in Baghdadi, you know, his name might well be apt, although I don't know that they are that close to taking Baghdad. That may be a little exaggeration on the part of the punditry. By the way, I must say, I was just watching CNN before we came on the air, and I find them so disgusting. I mean, it was outrageous to see their analysis on Wolf Blitzer. They had these neocons on, the Ambassador Zalmaday, the guy that was both ambassador in Afghanistan and Iraq under Bush, and Kenneth Pollack, the guy that was a cheerleader for the Iraq war. I mean, and they're all ragging on Obama, and nobody's saying anything about Bush and Cheney triggering this catastrophe.
I agree. This is being spun way out of control. But I want to get back to a more fundamental point that you had raised, which is I was taking notes during your previous section, and I came up with five reasons why we shouldn't be Chicken Little about this. The first one is the alliance between the Ba'athists and ISIS. That alliance is not going to work, as Jessica put it. You know, it's these are the jailers in alliance with those they jailed. Okay, that's number one. Number two is holding cities. Now they can be identified. It's a lot harder to go after individual terrorists who are plotting car bombs in caves than it is with people who have taken over cities, where they can be spotted and identified and potentially wiped out. They are fighting on multiple fronts. They are not only fighting in Iraq now, they are fighting also in Syria, and they are fighting a combination of everybody in Syria. They are fighting the FSA, the Free Syrian Army. They are fighting the Islamic Front. They are fighting Jabhat al-Nusra. They are fighting the PYD, the Kurds, in Syria as well. So they have multiple problems there. There's also the example of Mali, where the French had very little difficulties in wresting control of, albeit a smaller city, than Mosul, from the hands of al-Qaeda types that had taken it over. And finally, in terms of American domestic politics, there's the question of midterm elections coming up. And Obama cannot allow this sort of thing to go on. Now, what I think is going on, and this is maybe just my own predilection for optimism, is that this is being used now as a tool to put the squeeze on Maliki. In other words, Obama has been after Maliki to reform, to put up or shut up. Maliki has refused. Now what the United States is doing is appearing to dither, but in fact waiting for, well, playing a game of chicken, waiting for Maliki to come to some sort of an agreement to open up his regime and then perhaps put something together that could actually wipe this force out.
Well, I think that Jessica was suggesting that something has to happen, with or without Maliki. That would seem to be the case.
Maliki is part of the problem. He's definitely not a part of the solution.
But in terms of domestic politics, I think the Democrats have brought all this on themselves because they've allowed this nonsense over Benghazi to go on for so long, all of these stupid investigations. And all the Democrats had to say, okay, if you guys want to have the 100th investigation of Benghazi, let's investigate the beginning of the Iraq War as the British did. I mean, that's what we need now, so that we can have a little bit of honesty in this debate, but I guess...
Actually, that's what the Russians are saying.
Oh, they are?
Yeah.
God help me for quoting. Now I'm Putin's best friend.
We brought this on ourselves by invading Iraq in the first place.
Well, he's right. All right. Well, I thank you for joining us, James Galvin. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with James Gelvin, a professor of history at UCLA. His research focuses on the Middle East, particularly Greater Syria, the area of present-day Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, and the Palestinian territories. And he's the author of The Modern Middle East, A History. And his latest book is The Arab Uprisings, What Everyone Needs to Know. We're going to take a brief station break and be back joined in the studio by Sebastian Younger to talk about his new film, Korangal.
Over and over again, my friend. It's over. Where I he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head, even if he had to wrong someone. I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head, even if he had to wrong someone.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now in the studio is Sebastian Younger, who's an Academy Award-nominated filmmaker, journalist, and best-selling author, whose books include The Perfect Storm, A True Story of Men Against the Sea, A Death in Belmont, and War. His award-winning chronicle of the war in Afghanistan is documented in the documentary feature Restrepo, and in his most recent film, Korangal, which opens tomorrow in L.A. and across the nation later. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sebastian.
Thank you.
So the film clearly, you know, the Academy Award nominated documentary you did in 2010, Restrepo, was very much about, it actually allowed the audience to experience combat. And this follow-up film, I take it, the intention is to provide the audience with an understanding of how war affects the men involved.
That's right. I mean, it's kind of a subtle thing, but actually it's quite important. If you have a musical score somewhere in your brain, you know, you're not there. I mean, reality doesn't have a musical score. Reality doesn't have a narration or interviews with generals. So what Tim and I wanted to do with Restrepo was really create a film that didn't have any of those things. That just stuck you on a hilltop with a platoon in combat for 90 minutes. Korangal is different. Tim and I did interviews a few months after the deployment, and there were sections where the soldiers were talking very sort of deeply about complicated topics like courage, like and fear, and also very importantly, why they missed the war. You know, a few months later, they came back from one of the worst deployments of any platoon in the military, and a lot of them wanted to go back. And what is it they missed? What is it they wanted to go back for? That's what the film tries to understand.
And of course, when you talk about it being a horrendous deployment, I mean, in a sense, Restrepo, this outpost named after Juan Restrepo, who clearly was a very popular young Latino medic, I think, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was from the country of Colombia. He was an immigrant. Yeah.
But a medic, what was he?
He was a medic, that's right.
It almost feels like it was what they call the flypaper strategy, where you put your guys in the worst possible way to attract the enemy and then try and kill them. I mean, these guys felt like bait, right?
I think that was an inadvertent consequence of where they were. I don't think that was the stated strategy, but I think it kind of worked that way. The Korangal, 6-mile-long valley, few thousand residents, very backwards, extremely poor, very rugged. And it was being used by the Taliban as a base to attack the Peshawar River Valley, which was actually quite important, a large population, a lot of commercial activity, a lot of agriculture. And so the Americans were trying to develop the Pesh with a road and all kinds of things that the civilians actually needed and wanted. And so instead of getting attacked all the time on the Pesh, they just put a base in the Korangal, and that absorbed all of the sort of Taliban fury about all this, and the Pesh was quiet, and they were allowed to, that enabled them to finish their projects.
So what I found interesting about Korangal and the men and what they were saying about how combat was affecting them and was that they seemed like, you know, for what they were going through, to be pretty well adjusted. I mean, when you look at the news of the moment with Sergeant Bergdahl, and obviously it's become a political football between the Democrats and the Republicans, but it does seem that he, you know, he was kicked out of the Coast Guard. He washed out, after, you know, in basic training and for apparently for mental issues. And it doesn't sound like his unit was particularly cohesive, but there was a lot of fratricide. And a lot of these guys, you know, lent themselves to Republican political operatives to trash Bergdahl and by extension to trash Obama. So what's the overall picture here of the state of morale and, amongst our military?
I think it's hard to generalize. I think there are platoons that sort of go bad, you know, and maybe Bergdahl's was one of them. I have no idea. I can say that the fact that they were dressed sort of raggedly and wore bandanas and other stuff that reminds us of Vietnam has nothing to do with their level of discipline. And the military brass likes to think that, like, being dressed correctly, and your level of discipline is the same thing, but it really isn't. The guys I was with were dressed like hell. I mean, they were fighting in their boxer shorts and flip-flops at times, but they were incredibly good fighters and amazing soldiers. So we shouldn't judge that unit by the visuals. Mm-hmm. We shouldn't judge any unit by the visuals, I don't think, not in a frontline position like that. But that said, Bergdahl, I think, it just from what I've read, it seems like he was exceptional in some sort of puzzling ways. And maybe there wasn't a lot of unity within the platoon. I have no idea. I'm not sure. The big debate about him right now does, I think, seem to reflect more the politics in this country, the partisan politics in this country, rather than a sort of military reality over there.
But it does, in a way, sort of circle back, if you will, to the film and to the man that you profiled in the 10 months that you and Tim Hetherington spent there at Restrepo in this incredibly hostile environment. And that is that the U.S. is getting out, and all of these guys are going to be thinking, you know, what was it all about, surely?
It's hard to say. I mean, they, you know, the soldiers are very focused on their mission. And some guys are going to have the mission of leaving. That's their mission. And so the most important thing to them is that they don't get killed and their brothers don't get killed. And they don't, I mean, at least the guys I was with, they didn't evaluate the overall war very much. I mean, they, you know, you can get killed in a war that's working or survive a war that's not working. Which would you rather? You want to survive, right? And so to them, whether the war is sort of working or not isn't that relevant.
So they really weren't focused at any time that you can recall where on the idea that they're doing an important mission for the country, whatever, in the sense that in Vietnam, obviously, you know, we all remember what John Kerry said in his testimony, who wants to be the last guy to die in a sort of pointless war?
I don't think they saw it as pointless. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying that they didn't evaluate it really. And I mean, to them, it was extremely clear. Like, we're in Afghanistan for very obvious reasons. And so they don't, but their focus was on their mission and their deployment, their 14-month deployment. That was really what they looked at. And how that related to the rest of the country wasn't something, they just didn't think about it. Yeah, you know, World War II, you know, everyone went home when they got to Berlin. You know, I mean, there was a very, very different mindset about how the overall war was going because no one went home until it was over. That's not true with 14-month deployments.
Again, I'm speaking with Sebastian Younger, who's joining us in the studio. He's an Academy Award-nominated filmmaker, journalist, and best-selling author, whose books include The Perfect Storm, A True Story of Men Against the Sea, A Death in Belmont, and War. His award-winning chronicle of the war in Afghanistan is documented in the documentary feature Restrepo and in his most recent film, Corran Gold, which opens tomorrow in L.A. and across the nation later. You can find out where in your city from going to CorranGoldTheMovie.com. Now, Sebastian, there is, though, in Corran Gold, a real sense from some of the soldiers, for example, the incredible poverty. You see how backward this little village is right next to the outpost. And you know, I remember one of the soldiers saying something about, you know, bringing them up to the 20th or even the 21st century. And the idea that they're, you know, very suspicious of almost everybody because clearly the U.S. is not, in this case, is not winning hearts and minds, right? This is, you know, if that's the objective, it's not working. So they have to, for own survival, have to look at everybody with suspicion. And those two local kids that come up to the, you know, they test them for gunpowder residue. They always feel that whoever's out there is probably, you know, reporting on them. Was that the general sense that was one of being, you know, in a Fort Apache, not being able to, you know, trust anybody across the line, across the wire?
Yeah, I mean, I think they had the sense that the villagers told whoever showed up with guns at their door whatever they wanted to hear.
Uh-huh.
So when the Americans showed up, the villagers were sometimes perfectly friendly, at least at the shores, at the weekly meetings. You know, they could be very, very friendly, or they could be very tense. I mean, it was the whole range of human interactions, right? But I think basically the Americans thought, okay, when the Taliban show up with AKs at this guy's door, he's going to tell them whatever the Taliban, whatever they want to hear. And likewise with us. And they're just trying to survive. And so I think that was more the understanding. There's also this Pashtunwali, this code, this tribal code of hospitality. And anyone who shows up at your house, you have to sort of like treat them as a guest. And so there was a little bit of that as well. So, you know, they what they were trying to do is win hearts and minds. I mean, it's just sort of a funny phrase, but they, you know, basically if you alienate the locals, they will harbor the people who are shooting at you. Mm-hmm. And if you try to make friends with them and do things for them, they're less likely to. So there was one point where the Taliban dug a roadside bomb into the road. They'd already blown up a Humvee and a guy lost both his legs. And they dug another bomb into the dirt road outside the base. And, you know, one of the villagers from the nearby village walked up to the outpost and to the company headquarters and said, listen, be careful. There's a bomb in the road. You know, so that happened as well. Mm-hmm. It was sort of everything.
So there's no way to extrapolate out or make this any kind of metaphor for the overall U.S. experience in Afghanistan. This is just a window into what war does to men and how they survive and relate to each other under incredible duress.
It's not a microcosm of the overall war. The valley is 6 miles long, and there was a lot of fighting there. And in most of Afghanistan, there's no fighting. So it really isn't a microcosm of the overall war. But what the intent of the film isn't to really be any kind of comment on Afghanistan or on our war in Afghanistan. It's simply to provide people access to the effects of combat on young men. And I don't even say that in a kind of loaded political anti-war way. I really mean very literally, war affects young men in very good ways and very bad ways. And here they are.
And your colleague and co-filmmaker, cameraman, who spent the 10 months with you, Tim Heathering, of course, later he was killed in Libya.
Yeah.
And that was just shortly after the Academy Awards ceremonies, wasn't it?
Yeah, correct.
And you were here in L.A. for the...
Yeah.
I take it you miss him, right?
Of course, yeah.
Yeah. And do you have any idea of what was going on there? You know, was it just he was trying to cover that war?
We were supposed to be on assignment. We were supposed to be on assignment there together for Vanity Fair, and the last minute I couldn't go for personal reasons, and he decided to go on his own. And he was in the city of Misrata, which was, I was actually quite worried about him there. I sent him an email saying, I sort of don't like this, you know, be really careful. And he was spotted with a group of rebels on a frontline street, and they dropped a 81-millimeter mortar on him. Mm. And he got trapped on his groin, and he bled out in the back of a rebel pickup truck while racing for the Misrata Hospital.
Well, because as you know, Sebastian Younger, much has been made about Benghazi and all of this as a sort of, I guess, a way to get to Hillary Clinton, but...
Yeah,
that war, of course, whatever it was, has certainly left that country in complete chaos, you know, and
the uprising against Gaddafi.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the thing is, it's very, very complicated. My first war was Bosnia, and that was a terrible genocide until NATO intervened, and they stopped. They brought that war to an abrupt stop by dropping bombs on Serb positions, basically. Kosovo was next, Sierra Leone. Every war I've ever been in has been stopped by Western military action. And I think ever since Rwanda, ever since Bosnia, the West has sort of de facto agreed that if enough civilians are have died or under threat of death, morally we just have to do something. And Rwanda was the big regret of Bill Clinton's administration, of his presidency, that he did nothing while a million people were hacked to death. And, you know, I think the decision that Obama made, that President Obama made, was actually quite a brave one. I mean, you know, the Gaddafi's forces were surrounded and besieged Misrata and Benghazi, and it looked like there was going to be absolutely a carnage of in the order of thousands or tens of thousands of people. And so we did enough to keep that from happening. I don't think NATO's intervention didn't cause the chaos in Libya. That was it was on its own trajectory. But Obama did stop a process in those two cities that would have resulted in enormous deaths, number of deaths. And I think morally the West has the capability to do that. They can do it, you know, with virtually or zero loss of life for American forces. I think we kind of have to think really seriously about that. I mean, it's very hard, having covered these wars, it's very hard to say, well, you know, it's their problem. Let's just, you know, that's what makes Syria so painful, because there's nothing we can do. And they're still dying.
Well, you know, in terms of the way that these things translate in the political realm, and I you know, I guess something's happened to the country since perhaps certainly since World War II, that it's so rife with partisanship. You know, how many inquests have there been into Benghazi,
yeah,
where four people died, and yet there's never been an inquest into the Iraq war? And
yeah,
here today we're seeing Iraq essentially unravel, and the possibility, yeah, that Baghdad could even fall to the ISIS,
yeah,
mobs at lightning speed in their kind of blitzkrieg. So, you know, it's really hard to understand that we talk about, as a nation, about military virtue and how much, you know, nothing is too much for the troops and all that, yeah, propaganda here from politicians. But at the end of the day, they seem to not just use the soldiers as cannon fodder, if you will, but they also use the war itself as a political weapon.
I think the whole conversation would be very different if President Bush hadn't, in my opinion, very stupidly invaded Iraq. I think that was a complete game changer in terms of our relative power and control in the world. I mean, you know, everyone kind of understood Afghanistan.
You mean that it was because of 9/11?
Yeah, exactly. You know, you lose 3,000 people and any nation has the right to react. And our reaction was very, very targeted towards al-Qaeda. It's like, those people did that to us, we're going to go get them. And it made sort of basic human sense, I think. And Iraq was this elaborate, deceitful construction. I mean, the justification was, and it didn't work. And you know, the Afghanistan, there was a raging civil war there in the 90s. I was there in the mid 90s. It's terrible. After NATO stepped into Afghanistan, began the lowest level of civilian casualties in Afghanistan in 30 years. That's not true of Iraq. Iraq was not an intervention in an ongoing war. It actually created a war. It's the exact reverse. And so we really have to put them in two different categories. I think had we put the amount of energy that was put into Iraq erroneously into Afghanistan in 01, 02, I don't even think there'd be a war there right now. The Taliban really were a paper tiger. The Afghans were incredibly grateful to see us show up and to put an end to the civil war. We've done a lot of good there, and there'd be a lot of grateful people there if we'd done it right, and we didn't.
But there's always been the issue of Pakistani duplicity, though, hasn't there, in the sense that you could make the case that every American who died in Afghanistan, the blood is on the hands of the Pakistanis.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, yeah.
I mean, they seem to be having second thoughts now, that their own Taliban is attacking them in Karachi. I mean, it's almost like buyer's remorse, and perhaps they are afraid of reverse sanctuary. But when you were there at Restrepo in the Korangan Valley, that's pretty close to the Pakistan border.
It's like 20 miles, something like that, you know, a couple of days' walk.
Right. And was it clear that the guys that were shooting at you could get arms and sanctuary just across the border?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was just commonly known. I mean, they'd hear them speaking Pakistani on the radios, you know. I mean, they were bringing ammo in across the border. I mean, you know, you'd hear them on the American U.S. intel would pick up the radio communications of the Taliban saying, yeah, we got 20 crates of ammo coming in from Pakistan. I mean, absolutely. Yeah.
So to your mind, then, there's no question that Pakistan was, if not, they're certainly arming these people, whether they were micromanaging them or not. Who's to say? But, I mean, that's just a fact, is it not?
Absolutely. I don't think anyone questions that.
Right. Yeah. Right. But no one's done anything about it. At least, at the governmental level, we've never said anything to the Pakistanis. Maybe in private we do, but
we're stuck with this weird sort of marriage with Pakistan. It's a very dysfunctional marriage, and I don't quite know what the answer to that is. But
I spoke with a Pakistani journalist the other day, columnist with Dawn, the English language newspaper there. And she just ripped into America and blamed everything on America.
Yeah, of course.
I mean, I felt like, you know, I let people talk because I'm here to get information, not to put across the point of view. But at the same time, I was chafing, thinking, you know, give us a break, you know.
Yeah, I mean, they created the Taliban. I mean, that's absurd. That's really absurd. I mean, of course, America makes mistakes like every country does, and ours are larger because we're a bigger country. But they absolutely created the Taliban, and now they're suffering the consequences. I mean, they almost took over the Karachi airport. They're shooting schoolgirls in the head. You know, I mean, they're absolutely revolting.
So, and that is a condition that, that we're seeing in Iraq. ISIS, they were kicked out of Al-Qaeda because they were too radical. God,
yeah.
You know, we're heading into a weird period.
Oh, the good old days of Bin Laden, right? Like,
right.
We have a little moderate, like, where are all the moderate terrorists?
Right. So well, given that that's what we're going to be reporting on probably, in the, you know, is this incredible radicalization of particularly the Middle East. At the end of the day, just to, in closing, Sebastian Younger, what do you hope to impart from Corrin Gull? Because, I mean, Restrepo was a really powerful experience for anybody that hadn't been in combat,
yeah.
You know, to sort of to get an experience. And you and Tim Hetherington spent 10 months there along with these soldiers. And you, so you brought it back alive. And for that, we're very appreciative. What are you trying to impart with Corrin Gull?
Well, The guys are coming home now, you know. I mean, the soldiers, the vets, they're coming home. The next big project this country has to undertake, probably a harder one after the war, is the reintegration of all these fighting forces. And Corrin Gull uses, you know, went back into the material that was shot in 07, 08. It's a really extraordinary access that we had, that Tim and I had for a year with this platoon. It goes back into that material. It doesn't reuse any of the same footage, but it goes back into that body of work and tries to show what is the effect of combat on soldiers, on young men. It was all men out there. What are the consequences of all this? Because the consequences are coming home to us right now, the good and the bad, both, and there are both. And I'm really hoping that my film Corrin Gull, again, like Restrepo, a visceral, like in-your-face documentary, but I'm hoping that can help illuminate the situation that soldiers are in for civilians and even for the soldiers themselves. They're young men. They're confused sometimes by their experiences. I'm hoping Corrin Gull will sort some of that out for everybody.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today in studio, Sebastian Younger.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Sebastian Younger, who's an Academy Award-nominated filmmaker, journalist, and best-selling author, whose books include The Perfect Storm, A True Story of Men Against the Sea, A Death in Belmont, and War. His award-winning chronicle of the war in Afghanistan is documented in the documentary feature Restrepo and in his most recent film, Corrin Gull, which opens tomorrow in Los Angeles and across the nation later. You can find out where it's playing in your neighborhood from CorringullTheMovie.com. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.